show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we are here, oh, dedicated listeners and teammates, through de-bamboozling the collective dream, right? Dispelling dangerous delusions. So I'm welcoming longtime de-bamboozling accomplice, Josh Barron, that we may, with Neptune stationing, query about everything. Is this the thing or the symbol of the thing? Sometimes it's both, but it's useful. So I met Josh in 1981 when he was running Sorting It Out, which in Berkeley, which was a group for people leaving every sneaky form of cult. It was such a useful gathering, everyone sitting in a circle, some from the Catholic Church, some from Synanon, some from Steve Gaskin's farm, some from Muktananda, realizing that what got them into it was a good thing, seeking community. But then the cult is the toxic mimic of community. So that was good. And what gets us into the cult is often a good thing, made vulnerable by what Steve Behrman calls yearning disability, right? So Josh then is a communications and public relations mentor since 1982, best known for his work in the areas of, well, everything, public affairs, entertainment, films, nonprofit communications, crisis management, publishing, environment, technology, neuroscience, and religion. He heads up Barron, B-A-R-A-N, strategies.com, and he was a former Zen monk. And for nearly 30 years, Josh has assisted with the communications for many of the visits of the Dalai Lama to the United States, and it's the Dalai Lama's 88th birthday today. So, welcome, Josh.
Yeah, nice to be here again. It's been a while since we chatted.
Yeah, no, that's great. Exactly. I think I hosted you, I don't know, well, every 14 years, it's good to check in, right? I love how we met.
They don't change, too, so, you know.
Wait, say that again?
I say things change a lot, and yet at the same time, many things don't change all that much, you know.
Well, yes, so, you know, and at that time, I'd also written a book that I never bothered to publish called Lotus Feet of Clay, after my experiences in cults, toxic guru cult, toxic deranged Gurdjieff school, toxic whatever the thing is. But I think what was useful in your group and for all of us is just putting some standards on, like we did 13 years ago, too, which is, you know, a good group is one which guides everyone to their own autonomy. Is that fair enough to say?
Well, yeah, you could certainly say that. The thing about when people get together, we create culture, and we also can create cults. And every organization has the potential to become more and more cultic. And in fact, most do. But if you use that opportunity to pay attention, it can be a useful process. If you don't, it just descends into, you know, craziness and loyalties and just the old styles of thinking and traps people. So, you know, I think that the main thing that I think I offered at that, which was sorting it out back then, was the idea that it wasn't black or white. It was much more complex. And yeah. I really honored people's inner drive to wake up, to connect. And I didn't want them to throw that away. At the same time, I wanted them to open their eyes and become spiritual adults and not go along with, you know, with harm. Because the whole point of all this is to reduce harm and create more compassion. I think that's generally, we can talk about that. And if these groups, if things go sideways or dark, then they're making things worse, not better. And they're contributing to more neurotic and patterns and confusion. And that's never a good thing in this world. So,
right. And again, you know, in kind of astro mythology, we all, you know, planets represent living parts of our inner democracy. Saturn, authority, is the part of us we all tend most to outsource out there in the world to incompetent sociopaths, or anything that makes us cringe, right? And I remember just, you know, from your group, sorting it out, that across many borders, right, Catholic Church and everything, they were like, oh, it's the same. It looks different, but it's the same. Once there were certain, moments, you know, and there's also a kind of Jonestown thing. There's certain moments where, like, oh, it's time to skedaddle. It's almost too late. And that was when the guru or whoever was messing with people's relationship lives or their sexual lives, and it's like, oh no, time to go, right? Do you remember other warning signs, trip wires, in which you go, ooh, skedaddling?
Well, I think that first is you get an inner, your inner warning lights go off.
Right.
You know, something starts to flash inside and saying, this is, something's wrong here. But the challenge there is that many times we ignore it because we want something from the group or the teacher or whatever.
Yeah.
We want the certificate. We want the throne. We want to be a guru ourselves. We want magical powers. And so we just ignore the warning lights. And the more we ignore that, well, ignoring breeds ignorance. And so the whole thing is, the whole art is to pay attention when those lights are going off and to stop and say, what is that? What am I seeing? What am I, how, what's going on here? And also to question the dogma, because people, when they present dogma, they say, this is the truth. This is the way it is. And sometimes you need to say, is it true? Is that really the way it is? Is that just culture? Or is that some old way of thinking? You know, I mean, it's, we see this a lot, and it's really important. And that's what to me, the sorting it out thing was so valuable, because it really helped a lot of people become spiritual adults.
And yes, there you go.
And so the betrayal was actually, could be a very valuable thing. And maybe in many ways, to get to adulthood, you need, it's useful to be betrayed. I could say,
yes,
we don't want to seek it out, but when it happens, it can be an incredible moment, or not a moment, it's because it takes more than that, where you kind of wake up and you go from being a child who believes everything to, you know, to growing up. And it can be painful, but it can be so valuable. And I really am so grateful to my own process of going in my Zen community, which became cultic and authoritarian, and my struggle to leave, and all of that was the best thing that ever happened to me, was the struggle and what I dealt with, I think. And I saw that in a lot of people too, you know.
And no, and it's a theme, again, these themes live in us in fairy tales, and now Neptune, the intelligence without and within of dreams, vision, fairy tales, symbolic languages, and illusion and delusion, stationing wants our attention, you know. And and I also found that it's hard to leave if you're just one. Usually you need a conversation with somebody in the thing going, did you see this coming down? I think, and just as you say, a number of cults that I left, people are like, you're right, but I just want to stay a little longer for what you said, the secret knowledge, and the fear of outcast shame. I chose to believe this nonsense because I want to be part of this group, and I didn't want to be cast out into outer darkness, and then I forgot that I did that.
Right.
So, I mean, have you found
also
that
you need
usually...
You need to digest it, too. That's part of... I remember when I first started sorting it out, I put up posters in Berkeley, so long before the internet, you know, and it said, are you suffering from spiritual indigestion? And because it felt like you had to digest the experience, like it was really toxic, and yet there were some good, really good things in it for many people.
Mm-hmm.
That's not all true. So, some groups were only toxic. There's very little good in it, when I looked at some of the groups. But others, you know, like when I'm Rajneesh or Muktananda, you know, people got actually a lot of some... They got some interesting, good stuff from it. At the same time, they got some really, really difficult stuff, in some cases illegal and harmful stuff, you know, and when things got really crazy. But even then, afterwards, you know, it could be, again, digested, and you could get something out of it. And sometimes what you got out of it was, don't do that, or this is really dangerous, or this is too much, and that's also valuable, because you saw it for yourself, you know, directly.
Well, that's a crucial theme, you know, when in betrayal, you know, it does, the maturation that you reference and invoke is, you know, whom or what can I trust? Myself,
right.
You know, coming back to that. And and in fairy tales, one of the main templates is the hero or heroine is betrayed, is tricked and betrayed into a journey they didn't want to take, but it is going to turn out to be good for everybody. So that's a big theme and a good thing that you mention, and nuance, because we want to go into the con and the authentic, You know, and to be an effective con or delusion, you know, must have some truth to it to work. And therefore, we have, now we're in the world of complexity and nuance. You know, like, this is true. The control thing rides along with the truth is sort of the hook, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, but also your sort of your fantasies are a hook, you know, your imagination, you know, and it's not a bad thing. I mean, you are seeking, you're trying to figure out who the hell am I in this world, you know, and what's true and what isn't. And you know, it's true that you go back and after the betrayal and you leave, you go back to yourself, but then you have to question, like, what is that? So that becomes a real meditational or inner journey of, like, okay, what is true and what isn't true? Who am I in all of this? And actually, it's good to do it together to get support, but in the end, you also need to be kind of alone with it, too, as you kind of figure it out. And it can take a while, you know, like, you know, and it's funny with my situation, like, some people were shocked. It's like they'd say Zen, but Zen is so peaceful and so great. How could that be cultic? Mm-hmm. Well, that was just kind of the illusion of Zen, that the reality was it's much more complicated. And any organization can become cultic when both the leader and the members begin to get caught up, you know, in various kinds of illusions. And then they harm each other.
Well, the greatest tyranny I've ever experienced was in the Zen Center kitchen. Right? It was like, although it was a pretty good Zen master, Sun Sanim, really, you know, nuanced but pretty good. And I remember the head tyrant of the kitchen went to him and said, "Either this woman leaves or I do." And he just very calmly said, "You want to save all people except for one?" She's like, "Oh, foiled." Right. But I also wanted to bring up, you know, in our maturation process, I'm glad I got early when you show up at a group and they go, "Oh, you are the great one we've been waiting for." It's like, right, there's a hook. And it's seductive, and seduction is always a power thing as opposed to magnetism. But so that was good to have that hook early. So later I would show up at groups and they go, "Oh, you are the one who makes the five complete. You are the one we've been waiting for. The spirits told us you were coming." I'm like, I've heard that before.
I've had people contact me like that. And usually, you know, I remember there's one guy who's a producer and he called and said, you know, "God led me to you and you're going to make my movie great." And it's, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's like, I got off the phone as quickly as I could. I didn't talk to him again. I'm not interested in his story about me, which was complete fantasy. He didn't know me, and that wasn't going to happen. His movie was complete nonsense anyway. So,
We want, you know. Yeah. But I guess we're not going to drop names, or unless we can't help ourselves later. But it's useful that way. Well, I do love when I think the people who were doing The Secret, and I think you talked to the Dalai Lama, who said, "There's no secrets. Mm-hmm. There's this."
I'm not sure that Rhoda, what's her name, she called me about doing PR. Or no, she called me about something, and I thought she was like, this is Looney Tunes, you know, well, and this, so.
But here's, you know,
but
here's,
I think
where
we have to discern, we have to discern between the Looney Tunes and what, you know, and what's valuable and all that, so.
Right. And the reason I so love conversing with yourself and the part of you that is humming within us all, you know, is it is complex. We are pattern tracking beings. We love patterns. We love synchronicity, which is a thing, you know. But then there's the toxic mimic of the thing, where it's loaded up with specialness. I like composting the word special. And ladling out the word unique, right? Because special is a celebrity thing. We'll get to that. But unique encourages everybody to cultivate their unique gifts, mm-hmm. to contribute to the community. So, yes.
Well, that's what often keeps people in groups and in situations, is because they think we are so special. You know, we are the elite on the planet and on their universe, you know. And we see this in all kinds of groups where... they could even say, "Well, we don't believe that," but they live that, and they do say it over and over in one way or another. And so many groups had it, but if you left, you were losing your one opportunity. or you would go to hell, or you'd be reborn as a cockroach, or whatever the fear was. And that's something actually very important, is to look at any situation you're in, whether it's any kind of organization or even a relationship. Where's the fear, and how was it created, and how much fear is there? And that's a very important indication of what's going on with the organization. And because you find something that there's a lot of fear underneath it. It might seem all light and cheery, but like, if you break this rule, if you ever question the guru, hell, eternity, and it's worse than Catholic hell. I mean, they go into great detail about the hells, in some of these organizations
and
traditions.
When I was at a very young age off on a toxic guru trip to India, fly in sky with Lord of Universe, and I had a completely deadweight loser boyfriend I was dragging around India, because at a certain point the gurus, Mahatmas, stormed the Times of India building for writing a negative editorial and killed two guards, right? And I'm like, I'm out of here. And the deadweight boyfriend was like, well, don't leave me, but what if I'm missing my one opportunity for the, what if he really is the Lord of the Universe and I'm missing my, I go, you can stay, please. Please, you can stay. I'm autonomously heading out. There we go. And he's like, well, okay. Right, yeah, what if it is the one chance? Right. And we go, so there's some things we want to kind of toss into the cauldron for everybody, too. The specialness, the one chance. And then the sneaky, sneaky forms that so many good-hearted progressive people, including self, obviously get snookered into a colonial mythology. We are the awakened, enlightened people. We are the special 114. Everyone else is, asleep or a reptile. And I go, I like reptiles or whatever the thing is. And it's like, oh, that's just colonialism mythologically dressed up. It's like, just go. So I love your Scorpio self. We want the deep delving investigative. Because here's another thing that we just kind of want to put on the work table that we like. We like everyone's suspicion, creative suspicion, right? Like, what's really going on? What's really going on? That's a good thing. But what we see is so many people getting hoodwinked by their desire to not be hoodwinked, right? And might we put, are we putting certainty as a booby prize on the table? Or how do you want to, how shall we compost specialness? Or any response
well, also,
you might
people,
have.
One other thing, too, is that, so this is important, too, is that people have all kinds of experiences. Let's use that. That's the big word, experience, right? Especially now with psychedelics everywhere, is that it's not hard to have an experience. And some people have lots of experiences when they meditate or when they do various kinds of yoga or something. Other people don't. Some people see lots of bright lights and they dream of angels and all this. And part of all that is your mind, and you have to figure out what's more illusion, what are more sort of fabricated dreams, and is it helpful? And one teacher gave some very good advice. He says you might have a very powerful sort of energetic experience, but pay no attention to the visions or the story about it. Pay no attention. If it's a Buddha, if it's Jesus appear to you, it's just an image. Forget about it. It's not real. Now, the energy or the feeling can be very valuable, and you can work with that. But you have to not fall into some big story that simply your mind, like a dream at night, you dream of you dream you're a millionaire at night, you wake up, you're not. You're not a millionaire. That was a dream. And you can project a dream even during, with psychedelics, or even during if you meditate or whatever. And those can be very seductive, because then you're so special. You have this experience. You're different than other people. And then you go after these experiences. And I think I've had some very good meditation teachers that say if you go after any experience, it's poison. Any experience, it can become toxic when you hold on to it and you grab, because it's the grabbing that creates that contraction, that tension. So when they come and they go, the whole idea is to be more like the sky. Your mind is the sky. So you have beautiful clouds. You have a rainbow. Rainbow's just kind of an illusion. It's not there. You see a nice cloud. You see a storm cloud. It doesn't matter. You let it all go. If you don't, it just becomes more confusion for you down the road. And then you think you're so special. And that's not a good thing. That doesn't help anybody.
Right. Well, psychedelics, of which I am an enthusiast, however,
Yeah.
all these realms, so much of what you say, it's like Joseph Smith, a founder of Mormonism, probably took a big mushroom dose, right? And he had like, I have a vision, it's a religion. And a lot of people will have an experience, but they don't know that anybody else ever has, right? And part of it's education, going, yeah, but this happens, it doesn't make, it's not necessarily the truth, but it's an interesting thing. And I have to put the category, just 'cause you've fill in the blank does not necessarily fill in the blank. Just 'cause you've taken more DMT than anybody else on the planet does not necessarily mean you're not a climate crisis delusional cuckoo person, bless your heart. I've seen those things, and also just resonant with what you said, I just remember, Alexandra David Neal, first Western woman to go to Tibet and study. But yes, exactly what you said. She I think she's seeing lights, or she's levitating, or she's something, and she goes to her teacher, and he goes, pay that no mind. Pay that no mind. That's a distraction. Never mind those special that specialness thing. Just keep, and then I guess back to clouds, right?
But it's something that people get to be reminded about, because there is that tendency to say, well, I am, this is special, I am special. We have, always have to watch that, because that's a very common thing, and realize we need to let that go too, because it's just more, just there are different variations on sort of self-cherishing, you could call it, and
Which,
but
but again,
the question always is to figure out, what's true, what isn't, what's helpful, what's not. And you always have to be the authority. You really can't, you can have teachers, but you still have to be the authority yourself.
right. Where, encouraging everyone to all of us, in-source our Saturn, which is also, our sturdy mountain goat. Right, so if somebody gets our goat, right, it comes back even friskier and less obedient than before it got. These metaphors are useful. Self-responsibility, and also just being, where does this take us? And then the thing. So is this the thing or the symbol of the thing I find so useful? And in my own, tracking, always dangerous to mistake the mere mortal man for the myth. And Jung wrote about this, and he said, when mere mortals magnetize mythic projections onto themselves, and then he wrote with his characteristic dire gloominess, almost always forced to a fatal conclusion, right? One example of this was, the death of Princess Di was as the grief was as though the moon goddess had died. She was a sun in Cancer, incarnation of the moon. She's the mother of the solstice king. She dies on a lunar eclipse underneath the Place d'Armes, sacred to Hecate, while she's being pursued. But it was as though she was the moon goddess. And we go, okay. But now we come into now, and the example I always use, and it'll bring us into 2016, although we might go backwards and forwards. We know that cultures symbolically embedded their science in their myths and fairy tales, and the Inanna and Quetzalcoatl myth is a good example. Those are myths that are the Venus astronomical cycle. So Venus, as she is now, will be the evening star, really beautiful. There she is dancing with Mars. We can see it after sunset, and then she gets close to the sun and disappears, called Venus or going to the underworld. And then there's the moment. Beautiful, beautiful phrase called the heliacal rise of Venus, when she reemerges from the darkness as the morning star, and the heliacal rise. And in the Quetzalcoatl myth, Quetzalcoatl is a pretty good leader, but then Tezcatlipoca, the Lord of the Smoking Mirror, comes to him and whispers in his ear, going, "You're getting old, you're not so cute. Here, drink this bolche, drink this intoxicant." So he does. Right? And he gets carried away, and he breaks all the taboos, and he makes horrible deals with corporations, and betrays his trust, and sleeps with his daughter, and in the morning wakes up with a terrible hangover, going, "I've done terrible things. I must go away. I must go away. But I will return once I become worthy and wise. I return with the heliacal rise of Venus." Right? So it was meant to be where cultures, everyone, right? Not even just the leader thing, but going, "Oh, where have we become corrupt? let us go into a deep retreat, you know, and then with the Hyacal rise of Venus, wise leadership will return in all of us. And it was a terrible historic oops that at that crucial moment, Cortez shows up. And Mesoamerica mistakes Cortez for Quetzalcoatl, right? The murderous thug. So just fast forward, I'm with the Pacifica team covering the 2016 Republican convention, and it's the same. It's about to be the Hyacal rise of Venus, and it doesn't matter if we don't know these things. They live in us, right? And I could see, like, oh no, the it's not Mesoamerica, it's Middle America. Middle America is perceiving the former guy as if he were a god. And it's like, oh no. Right. And but it was so powerful, I want to toss it back to you about symbols, that afterwards I fell to my knees out under the stars, and I go, oh God. Because I knew what was going to happen. Because Hillary had no symbolic or language craft, right? And there was Trump saying, I will bring to you your deepest desire that you've always wanted since you were a child. He said that. I mean, that's what it's like, and it got people. And I was like, oh no. Yeah.
He figured that out. I knew very early on he was going to win. I just said, he's going to be the next president. Hillary can't.
How early? Let's have early competition. How early did you know he was going to win?
I don't know how early it was, but it was fairly early on, just because I get a sense that he really was tapping into this.
Yes.
He was tapping into something that, you know, that Hillary was just such a controlled politician, and she said all the right things in the right way, and Trump was the one that just sort of flew, you know, just spoke. Even when it was, you know, vile, people loved the spontaneity of it. They loved the energy of it. They got caught up and they got seduced by it, enchanted by it, bamboozled. It was a total bamboozle.
Yes.
And those are right. Can be very powerful to people because they have no context for it except that, you know, and then he becomes a savior, and he became worshipped, literally, right? You know, we see all these people worshiping him, you know, and he's anointed, he's divine, and so on, which is sort of such a joke with this particular person. He's such a, you know, a creepy guy, and so lacks no morals or ethics, and those Christians didn't care because the myth was so strong for them, right?
And we're going to address the ongoing danger. Right, and that's another just sort of category I want to put on the altar for us all, just, you know, for everybody to put in their magic backpacks if you are so moved, which is prison masquerading as freedom, right? That con going, ooh, and it's like, yeah, and as you say, I mean, everything can be liberating or imprisoning. Astrology, Pacifica Radio, you know, Zen Buddhism. I mean, everything has the potential to be imprisoning or liberating, or at least I think that's a useful category, right?
No, I mean, I see it like, you know, since I've been close to the Tibetan Buddhist world, there are groups that are really wonderful and open, and it feels very healthy, generally. Still patriarchal, but within that context, it's pretty good. But then you go to other groups, and it's really tight and cultic and mean. It can be it's the same religion, you know, but in a different hands, it becomes really different. And there's groups where there's a lot of fear. They're all afraid of going to hell. So every little thing becomes a big deal. And also that you can't say, you know, what I often tell people in about organizational stuff is when you go to a new organization, the first question you like to ask is, what can't you talk about here?
Oh, that's good.
What can't you talk about? And usually people get very uncomfortable. Oh my God, because they can't talk about.
We can't talk about that. we can't talk about what we can't talk about. ooh, and it might make daddy or mommy angry to have that such things.
Oh,
that's right.
Beyond anger, you'd be cast out. I mean, you know, it's there. There's a lot of that. Like, you know, you think one negative thought about your teacher, and that's the end of it. You're going to hell for eternity.
Right. There's many things. We're going to take a very, very short, our usual fantastic Taj Mahal musical break. My accomplice, ally in de-bamboozling, liberating, we're aspiring, is Josh Barron. His website is Barron, B-A-R-A-N, strategies.com. And we'll be right back.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Ooh, chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, here with my splendid accomplice, Josh Barron, who is a former Zen monk who went on to help people out of cults, but to discover where there's, you know, counterfeit, there's also real gold, and now has been doing PR for good causes for many, many years. That's wonderful. So I am the reason I'm so glad you could come play is I'm feeling enthusiastic urgency about the danger that we're in now, culturally, you know, that people would outsource their authority without calm discernment. Is that a fair thing to pitch back to you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. All right.
Yes. Discernment's a good, that's a good word, discernment. We like that.
We love discernment. You know, and... You know, that's an interesting thing too, because we want to discern about discernment. The culture has become kind of criticism averse in a way. We go, no, criticism, discernment, diagnosis, healing. I miss my buddy Robert Bly, who was a great mentor, as it turned out. I mean, I think you took me to a poetry reading a million years ago in 1982, and I was like, wow, that's really good. And then he became slightly toxic, and the misogynist thing for a moment, and he and I had a public face-off, but then we met in a deep way, and there we go. But he was, he got kinder and still really spicy. And the thing that I miss is, if somebody read a terrible poem, he would say, that's a terrible poem. It's not really even a poem. And if you're serious about this, then you should study with, you know, Fran Quinn, right? And then there's this culture of like, well, anything that anybody does is good, and if you criticize it, you're shaming them. And it's like, no, the infantilization, it's like criticism, I think discernment, it does have to do with motivation and timing, you know, why, to what purpose, and is its intention to diagnose, gnosis, healing. I mean, that's important. But I'm in favor of bringing vetting standards back, you know, and being able to call a bad poem, and, you know, and we would want that. I have great friends who listen to the show or read my stuff and are honest, right? And they, I mean, if it's good, they go good, and if it's not, they go, you win some, you lose some. And it's a reliable part of friendship to be truthful and critically honest, I think. I mean, I value that as a part of friendship, that one can critique, you know, and it's received and taken well. Is that
right? So you have now this whole, on this, you'll see this on a lot of college campuses, but other places, where if you said to somebody, that's a terrible poem, they would now say they were traumatized.
Right. Oh, God.
And they might, you know, feel, say, oh, my God, you know, that was a racist thing to do, or, you know, how dare you do that? And there'd be a whole thing. I mean, and why is saying your poem is terrible traumatizing? It's not. It's just like, that's first off, that's their opinion. But secondly, do you want to become a better poet? Well, you need to hear, you know, what, you know, take it in. Otherwise, life becomes very limited, and you can't handle anything, really.
And the nobility of failure. I remember when Ingmar Bergman died, great and complex and befoibled filmmaker. but his buddies were saying, you know, Ingmar Bergman made 10 terrible films. before he made a good one. And we do grieve that that should be a part of ourselves. To do it and fail, to make 10 terrible things, to write 10 terrible chapters, you know, and to have that, you know, and to not pretend it's wonderful, but to go, oh, that really is terrible. Okay, back to the thing. Number 11, that's a winner, right? And it's part of, you know, kind of what we're aspiring, right? That you mentioned the maturation of culture, going, yeah, you know, to fail. I've excavated, last week's guest mentioned this kind of obscure book, but it's on my bookshelf, called The Nobility of Failure. It's a great book about Japanese culture. And as a friend, you know, seeing it on my bookshelf said, good bedtime reading. And it's like, it is good. But, you know, trying and failing and going, well, that could have been better. But if we don't have, if people are tiptoeing around, well, anyway, well, we've sort of done that part. But the idea also of, so let's go on what fuel are things running, and you know the hungry ghost theme. Although it's interesting now, right? Because it's like sort of, you know, Prigozhin and Putin, all right, kind of the Dementors taking each other out, Boebert and, you know, Three Toed Green, kind of taking each other out, and the Freedom Caucus just kicked Green out, right? And we go, oh, that's fine too. You know, so in a way, it's like, you know, if we step out of the way, let me offer this to you as a hopeful thought. If we step out of the way, do you think tyranny will take itself down in some forms?
Well, they will tear each other apart to some extent, but they're still going to be, you know, top dogs, and they're still going to be some people come out stronger. But yes, they'll go after each other because it's all about purity and loyalty and who's the most right wing or who's the most, loyal to Trump and all of that. So, but I think they will to some extent, but and they could also take down the world at the same time. So it's not.
That's true.
A guarantee of a positive outcome.
It could take a while. But on one level, it's like, okay, that's one small story. And that's also the idea of, you know, complexity, multiple stories and nuance, and we're all befoibled, and this is a befoibment, and this is a good thing, and discerning. But I think also, we spoke backstage, and I've been using it a lot since my friend Pat Ewing's brought up, you know, what is the antonym of grievance? And I go, oh, that's such a very good question, because authoritarianism runs on grievance. And I always invoke Terry Pratchett's wonderful novel, I Shall Wear Midnight, where the cunning man has come to town and created mob mind that encourages cruelty and the rough music that causes people to do terrible things, right? And the young girl witch has to dissolve that. But she says, grievance, the cunning man finds purchase in all whose hearts are full of grievance and resentment and revenge. And I think that's such a useful thought. And then I said to myself, going, well, I don't have grievance. And then we have these tripwires, right? And it's like, I didn't. We pull them up, right? It's like, And I do want to make some discernment, like we can keep discernment and we might even have grudges, but grievance is really mean, right? And it obscures grief.
Grievance is like, I think, a systemic thing, you know, that it's your whole stance. Your grievance about everything, like Trump or Hitler. They had huge grievances, right? They're the victim. They're the great victim. There's never been a greater victim in the history of the universe.
Right.
You know, and they love being that victim because that gives them the energy of revenge, right? Of action, and then you try to take out you project the shadow onto the, you know, other people, and then you try to, you know, take them out. Holy war. So this is what we're dealing with now, is really holy war. Yeah, this is holy war right now in America. We have a lot of this. There have been a lot of new books come out rather recently about, you know, the dangers of that right now. But because they dress it up in churchy language or thoughts or whatever, but it really is the idea of, these are evil people and they have to be, you know, eliminated. And this is an old
right.
an old dance, you know, and it's
and the
tragedy.
The kidnapping of language and symbols. I remember in Bali, and also when I was kind of reading the history to prepare for going there, with the U.S.-backed death squads that were roaming the villages in the 60s, killing farmers as communists. The farmers were like, could we talk about land? No, you're dead. But the death squads wore the sacred forest god masks, right? And it's like, when they killed people, it's like, oh, that's so wicked. But it's an extreme and horrific thing of, you know, symbols, who's got the symbol, right? To appropriate a powerful symbol or a resonant thing, or, you know, we are here to unify the world. We go, well, we love that idea. We are here to heal division. But yes. And then we watch because polarity feeds tyranny. And I think part of the gaslighting where we feel conniption fits or whatever is the thing is like, yes, we want unity and to heal division, but it's very grievance divisive. So it's the actual toxic mimic of the thing. I have a, you know, flag on play, you know, embodying what one decries, 5-yard penalty, declined, ball back in play, right? But there's a lot of that about, you know, and then the sneaky ways in which we all get snookered into polarity, which feeds tyranny. Just even, do you like this or not? Do you approve or disapprove? I'd like to throw approval, disapproval into the cauldron, because it's like, do you approve or disapprove of this thing you just heard about a minute ago? It's like, no, it does. Right. That's not useful. But yeah, the many hooks, and people write about this, but I think it's important for us all to pay attention. Like, you know, even, you know, not even, well, on Twitter, right? That there are outrageous things, like, oh my God, that's horrible, right? And then I want to hand this back to you for complexity. We want to know about horrible things, right? We do. That, like, oh my God, that, and to embrace kinship with the person who's received this tremendous injustice, we want to do that. But it's a, there's a discernment here about just jumping in. There was, I forgot what it was, but there's a million of these too, in which you know, something terribly sad happened to somebody's dog by mistake. At a shelter, and then people are like, "Oh, that's terrible. We're so sorry for you." And then soon it was the mob. We should march there and kill those people, right? We should do that thing. And it's like, whoa, okay. So concern. I like to make the distinction about between reaction and response. If we love freedom, yeah, okay. To react to anything is not free. It's not about that, and it's hot, right? To respond, right, is to be engaging in an ever-larging repertoire of responses, right? Is that a fair thing to put on our
right? But I was also thinking, what is there? You can feel anything you want, and of course, it's just your own reaction. It doesn't, you know, doesn't mean it that much, except to you. But if you want to make a difference, you want to change something. You want to, let's say, there was a dog was somehow harmed at a shelter or something. Okay, fix it. How do you prevent that mm-hmm. from happening again? What can you do?
Right.
Well, that's a lot harder, isn't it? Because it might take weeks or months or years, right? And it might, you bump into politics and personalities, and it's a whole process. And that's where a lot of people, you know, it's easy to feel these reactions, but then if you want to take action. So for my mind, since I was so involved in sort of activism kind of issues, always like, what could you do that would be effective? Not just how you right. make you feel better, right, or feel righteous, but how would you actually change something? And mm-hmm. sometimes that's actually really challenging. It's difficult. And then the great thing would be to bring to use that opportunity as a kind of as a spiritual part of your journey, in other words. So to notice your mind as you do it, how you, I would demonize somebody or not to not see their humanity, not understand, and then find a creative way to make it better, and that's always it's a big challenge. It's easy
right.
to just feel righteous about something, and you know, but that doesn't do anything really.
Right. So, there are so many tripwires. There's so many tripwires out there, you know, and as Neptune is stationing, again, true vision that is unifying. I like my friend Deborah living in the Middle East says, Salam, peace is not the absence of conflict, it's the presence of oneness. We're all in this thing together, which is useful. You know, and then, you know, the tripwires are, you can be having a civil conversation with somebody and then, you know, there's a tripwire, like Ukraine, vaccines. And it's like, it's like the old movie, Slowly I Walk, you know, until or the Manchurian Candidate, when the spooky word is mentioned, it's like, oh my God, okay. So just sort of dissolving this, you know. So yeah, we were mentioning the conspirituality folks whom I will host at some point. And it's a podcast, which I find refreshing in its critique. I have also great friends, you know, who are in the kind of actual Mayan scholar community and actual historical archaeology, right, who are kind of taken off. It's not all built by aliens. That's a racist, mean kind of thing. And I'm grateful to all who are upholding standards. But we do want the more nuanced kind of complexity, too, because it's like there is some good here, and then this is bogus delusion. So the conspirituality folks, I'd written almost exactly the same thing, but here's their language. There is, in us, the myth, you know, in our political landscape too, of the noble outsider whose unifying vision goes beyond business as usual, who will save us. You know, reconciliation, unity, healing the divide, you know. We go, right. And yet, here's the proper direction for our creative suspicion, going, well, what's the feeling? What's the field? What's the actuality? And you go, oh, but actually underneath that pleasant pablum, right, is a punitive oppositional grievance-fueled thing, right? The poison of polarizing pablum disguised as the desirable. So it's like, so we do want a little, right, but it's tricky, right? Even saying that, some people might be getting in a huff. There we go. No, don't drive off in your hybrid huff. No, come back driving the hybrid huff. You know, we can converse, you know, and then realizing, you know, and part of this is the extensive, you know, conspirituality work with the Wagner Group and QAnon as a global thing. It's huge. I had no idea. It's huge. And the troll farms, Prigozhin's troll farms that Putin's now taking over. It's huge and money making, right? But QAnon is an Italian, Eastern Europe. It's a global thing. So how are our fellow global citizens, you know, vulnerable to the totalitarian Q virus? I have a few answers. I think dogma and certainty and addiction to having an enemy. But what do you think about, you know, how is it that so many of our fellow global citizens have been infected by the Q virus in their desire to not be infected or whatever? I just hand it back to you now, and here it is.
Well, I mean, I would say that it's a basic, I forget, an enchantment, and it's a very exciting enchantment for some people.
That's good.
Because, as I say, you know, for most people, life's kind of boring, and things. Also, we don't understand a lot of things, or how things connect. We don't, and we want to know for sure. We want certainty where there is none, right? And suddenly, you have somebody that comes along, and this, so the case is the web and all this stuff now, and has all this incredibly exciting, weird connections, and. If you begin to feed on them, they're very seductive, because it's kind of exciting. Oh my God, I just have this connects to that, and this is what's really going on, and you know this is not what you think it is, and it suddenly you're in the know, you have secrets, you have connections that nobody else has, and it's better than a movie, it's better than an Indiana Jones, isn't it? You know,
and you're
a player, and you're also you're a player in it somehow. You know, I think we've had various forms of QAnon, but now I think it's just in the past, but now we have a whole new way of people self-indoctrinating themselves rather than having, you know, the cults was like always they would indoctrinate you, but now people self-indoctrinate. Just they go down the rabbit
what
hole
do you mean?
All these videos and. Well, I mean, you know, you can go on YouTube right now and just search under QAnon, and you'll start seeing more and more different kinds of videos, and about all kinds of things. And if you follow it, you could spend days, weeks, months, getting all this new information, and it's kind of exciting. It can be thrilling to some people rather than disturbing. Well, it's like, wow.
And there is a compensatory condescension going, I know, and you don't. Now we're back to specialness. But again, where we want to discern is, you know, all my life, I also like, you know, learning and figuring out how are we being snookered. Like in seventh grade, I, you know, did a paper on the advertising industry in this really great book, still great, called Subliminal Seduction, about how we are manipulated. And it's like, I want to know that. I want to know that. And that's a good part of us that wants to know that. And this is where we get nuance and complexity, you know, and tracking things, you know. And I think for me, because the QAnon or whatever, you know, sort of swept through the New Age yoga astrology community and apparently most of the island of Bali. And it's like, there are little, just as we have receptors, you know, we have the toxic mimic, you know, that fills our receptors. You know, for lack of a guiding mythology, we have the toxic mimic of a celebrity culture. So one of my sort of responses to wondering, like, how does this happen, is dogma. Dogma. Anytime we believe something or derive credit or status from something that we haven't really earned, we are vulnerable to being taken over, you know, to outsourcing and deriving our sense of importance from a delusional story, you know, which is not intrinsically democratic, right? So that's one of the answers. But I think these are, for me, you know, and then certainty. It's an uncertain time, right? And simple certainty is imprisoning, right, as opposed to, you know, fluidity. And the addiction to having an enemy. And that's the quirky thing about, you know, all traditions, right? And the shamanic tradition, bless its heart, many good things. But it does, its shadow is an addiction to having an enemy. Because we are great, we are being attacked, you know, by this thing. And that's also in the political realm, you know, any critical piece of writing is called a hit job. This also is complex. I mean, there are unfair writings, right? But it's like, might we want, oh, Josh and all dedicated listeners, just to relax and expand the realm of what we're willing to think about, you know, and information, research, you know, useful to dive in, you know, before one has an immediate, like, no, or yes, you know,
I think part of it is we do have to keep on. I think there are conspiracies. We know this in history. There have been we can call conspiracies. There were political conspiracies and religious conspiracies. There are many powerful groups that maintain their power through, you know, all kinds of nefarious means, and they weren't public, so they exist. So we shouldn't deny that's part of human culture, but we have to see more clearly what's real and what isn't. Because if we just follow more fantasies, we create more and more conspiracies ourselves, you know. And we have to be willing to be challenged and you know, and see what's true and what isn't. And if we don't know that it's true, maybe it's not true, you know.
Or we can just wonder and leave it there without having an immediate opinion, going, let's
right. So
see
we
about
have
that.
To be comfortable with not knowing. Just not knowing, you know, and it's because somebody says what, you know, the universe is full of mystery for most of us, most of the time, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. And, but groups like QAnon and churches and many other institutions tell us they know exactly what's going to happen, you know, and they explain everything.
So I want to go back to, it's the Dalai Lama's 88th birthday and it's George W. Bush's 77th birthday. Quite different people. But the Sabians, they share the same sun degree, and the image for that is an old man faces the darkness in the northeast. And it's like, ooh, I bet they have different experiences of that, the Dalai Lama and George W. Bush. but it did make me want to go back to 2000 and 2004. And one of the things for which, you know, RFK Jr. is mocked, I think, inappropriately, well, there's a couple things. GMOs are bad. Yes, I think that's right. The 2004 election was stolen, pretty much for sure. Reading a lot about this, and then I just wanted mm-hmm. to, and then back to 2000 also, and then just the thing that I'd mentioned to you that I find astounding. G.W. Bush, his legal team in 2000 that basically robbed the election through the Supreme Court, it was a three-person legal team, and all three of those people are now on the Supreme Court. It's John Roberts, it's Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Comey Barrett, and it's like, they've been working on this for 23 years, right? And a lot of the people right. back in 2000, 2004, Roger Stone and the Dirty Tricks people, they're all here now. These are long, long players of grift, right? So yeah. any words of blessing or dispelling or depossessing or
well, no, I mean that you want to clearly, you know, again, a lot of it went on in the shadows, and it yeah. needs to come out. We need to see what they're doing, but it's, you know, it's all the federal society and a lot of money, billions of dollars, has gone yeah. into this. The long term, and that they play the long game, and they're getting what they want in the courts, not just the Supreme Court, but in federal courts. All the judges that Trump appointed, they're Looney Tune nuts, some of them, but they can be very obstructive, and they can really harm. They can really deny rights and for lots of people, and make things very difficult. And you know, I think that that's why that you know we can't avoid the politics. We can't sort of withdraw from all of this because it has real consequences when this kind of harm becomes, you know, takes over.
That's why I'm so delighted that you. I was like, I'll call up Josh. I want to talk to Josh. I haven't talked to Josh. I know the way to talk to him is have him on the radio. That's good. And I think you said you hadn't been doing much of this, and I go, your country needs you. It's like the gunslinger character in Cat Ballou emerging from retirement. We go, no, you have Pluto on your ascendant, young lad, Josh Barron. It's all about, you know, citizenship. What is good citizenship, and what are those skills? But thank you so much for your discerning, putting vetting standards on our collective work table to guide everyone to their own autonomy. Thanks very much, Josh Barron.
Sure, I hope I've been helpful. Happy to chat anytime.
That's wonderful. All right, let us talk further. Let us talk further. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas, wonderful, wonderful board op. I'm Caroline Casey. CoyoteNetworkNews.com and brewing a dream council that will be delving in many of the ways that we've described this thing. CoyoteNetworkNews.com. You can find out more ways to play. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, team.